Welcome to the 174th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Happy birthday, David Gower, who's 67 today. Welcome to the podcast that dreams of having his smoothness, or failing that, we would also take a joyride in a tiger moth while our teammates were playing cricket below.
So it's the 1st of April today. Have we got any special April Fools prepared for our loyal listeners?
I was if we have, that's probably not the greatest setup, is it? And trying to find the April Fools, and I failed. And I was instead trying to find all these stories that sound absurd, but are in fact true because, you know, the world is absurd. So, yes, I don't know if there's a deeper reflection there that, you know, the news cycle is so mad that...
Okay, so basically what we're saying is welcome to the April Fools edition of Reverse Threat Radio that in no way reflects the fact that it is the 1st of April. But instead, we have got all kinds of exciting things for you. We are going to be talking about we're going to be talking about cricket in France, which is not something we often do. We're going to be talking about Liam Dawson, which is also something we don't often do. We're going to be delving back into the archives to pluck a gem from cricket's golden past, which is something we do every episode. And we're going to be reviewing Cricket's Greatest Game, a BBC documentary from 2022, which, spoiler alert, Andy hated. Now, Andy, cricket in France.
Yes, so we, as you say, don't talk about this very often, but France cricket decided to encourage the women's game by requiring that a men's team couldn't play in the top division unless their club also had a women's team. And they enforced this rather robustly with fines if women's games didn't take place, so if a club couldn't raise a team. A former French cricketer, Tracy Rodriguez, turned detective. She saw the list of women's games that were scheduled and went along to watch. She repeatedly found that games were not being played, but that the results were still diligently being posted on France Cricket's website. What she had discovered was a ghost cricket league. The clubs were just making it up. Now, I think this story is a wonderful parable of cricket development done very badly. Obviously, none of us can disagree, and I think the progress of the last few years shows what can be achieved by putting effort into developing the women's game. But you have to reflect and think that lying was actually a pretty understandable response for these amateur clubs. You know, cricket in France is not a lucrative undertaking. They could ill afford to pay the fines. And they were being offered coercion rather than any support by their governing body. And I think for people who know about this stuff, and, you know, we've done actually quite a bit recently on the podcast, things like the wonderful book on South American cricket, which went into how you try and grow the game. Development takes skill, it takes effort, it takes time. You can't just turn up and demand it through a set of rules.
So a couple of things. Firstly, are you sure that this isn't the April Fool's segment on the podcast? Because it does kind of feel unlikely, this, you know, that in front the people of France are madly posting scores from, you know, zut alors, they're making up scores from games that don't exist.
Well, you've prompted me to give credit where it's due, actually, which is I discovered this story on Jared Kimber runs a rather good Substack called I want to say Good Areas. Anyway, I'm sure if you search Jared Kimber Substack, you'll find it. And it came up on this, and it came up with the title which I've just plagiarized with affection, which is the Ghost Cricket Leagues of France, which, as you say, would be it's a superb title for anything, actually, isn't it? It's a superb title for a novel called the Ghost Cricket Leagues of France. But yes, it appears to be true. It has been reported on widely. I did have a look, being the diligent podcast host that I am, I did have a look to see if there'd been any sort of progress in the story. But as far as I can see, as yet, there seems to be a mix of sort of sheepish denial from the French cricket authorities and not much more.
And as you alluded to, it shines a light on this question of sort of carrot versus stick when it comes to development and inclusion and all of these other things. And it's kind of the question of, well, why would you do these things? Why would you, as a club in France, playing a game like cricket that probably not many people in France play, why would you care about putting out a women's team? Is it because someone's given you a rule to do it, or because actually someone's incentivized you in a different way? And I think there's a lot to learn in a number of different sectors at the moment, and this kind of similar approaches around carrot versus stick to these kinds of issues.
I think so. And I certainly wouldn't claim expertise. I mean, I know people have travelled all over the world sort of promoting the game in different countries and have learnt this sort of in the hard way. I wonder if coercion would work at a later stage. So if you've got a much, much more developed club game, more resources, maybe some sort of rule like this would work. But when you've got clubs that are in themselves probably not super developed... And I also think it's a kind of laziness, I think, on behalf of the governing body, because really what you want from France Cricket is some sort of intelligent support.
Are you putting resources into grassroots cricket, or are you just making random punitive rules to try and make everyone else do the work for you?
Exactly. And I think this is how lazy regulation often works, right? You can't solve the problem yourself, so you get someone else to do it. Clubs. And the other thing I should say that was this was another great example of honesty being punished, because the few clubs that were honest and paid the fines were obviously, you know, handing over hundreds and hundreds of euros for this, while the clubs that were making up the results kind of merrily got on with their ghost league. I should have, if I'd been a really good podcast host, I'd have checked these results. I'd have been interested to see, you know, were we getting phantom hundreds made here and phantom five wicket
holes
and things.
We could do whole features on these games, couldn't we? Describing these nail-biting encounters in, you know, wherever they are, the Auvergne.
Could be a lovely trip, actually, going around and touring some of these cricket games that aren't happening.
Sitting in some empty fields.
Now, another thing that isn't happening, and I think a lot of Hampshire fans and county stalwarts are a bit sad about this, but is Liam Dawson's England career.
Yeah, so Liam Dawson last week, maybe this week, resigned, didn't resign from Test cricket because he doesn't really have a Test cricket place, but he resigned from trying to have a Test cricket place. He's always been someone who's been slightly on the periphery of my cricket vision. You know, he's one of those spinning all-rounders who were unable to hold down a place in the England team. I admit this is a slightly unfair illustration of his career, but in kind of looking through his stats, I realised that he has, in his career, played for more 2020 franchise teams than he has played Tests, ODIs and 2020s for England combined, the number of matches combined. Which I don't think... that sounds like a glib dismissal of his career. It's less of a judgment. It's more of just of an indication of the route that he's gone down as a player. There was this interview that was done with him, this pre-season interview that was done with him last week, in which he ruled himself out of England honours. It was the kind of interview where he played a couple of sort of defensive shots to a couple of early questions in the interview before just kind of thinking, I'll bugger this for a laugh, I'm just going to tell them what I really think. I think he realises that the ship has sailed. He wasn't one of the three spinners who was taken to India for the last Test series, but he just talks about the fact that he's just fed up of carrying drinks. And when he could be playing for Hampshire, as you say, but he could also be playing lucrative short-form games. He's going to South Africa soon. He would rather be doing that. In the interview, he repeatedly talks about the fact that he's 34. He talks, you know, he prefaces a lot of what he says with the statement, at this point in my career. And I suppose it's a reminder that building a career in cricket is, you have to be pragmatic, just as you have to build a career in any form of industry. You can't go through your entire time hoping that you're going to succeed somewhere that, frankly, you're not going to succeed. You can't get to 34 years old and think that you're going to be England's next spinner when all the signs are telling you something different. But the thing that struck me is it's quite rare that you hear someone coming out and saying this explicitly, and sort of good on Liam Dawson for doing so.
I think he had the most remarkable year last year with Hampshire. This probably came up a bit in the interview. You know, he took loads of wickets, piled on a really crazy amount of runs. And I think when he wasn't taken to India, I think there was this combination, as you say, of him saying, look, I've got, you know, the South Africa gig, I also don't want to carry the drinks. But I think also England had this thing around the tall spinners, you know, they had that strategy, which I think there's some evidence for it being successful. The other thing I wonder is, I just sometimes think we do county achievement down. So, you know, we sort of see someone's county achievement as a way of getting picked for England.
Yes. When it means nothing in and of itself.
Exactly. And Liam Dawson's had the most wonderful career for Hampshire. You know, I'm sure Hampshire fans and many county fans, that in itself is kind of enough. Did it come across in the interview? Was there a sense of regret what might have been, or was this someone who basically
very straightforward? And I mean, I don't know Liam Dawson well enough, personally not at all, and through his interviews not very well at all either, to be able to sort of read him. But he just seemed very pragmatic and straightforward. And that was the thing that I came away with, was thinking, yeah, well, why would you keep on trying to play for England under these circumstances? Surely you just pick another route for the rest of your career.
So that was the Liam Dawson exclusive, but I can confirm here that both Toby and I are very happy to carry the drinks or do anything else with the England setup. You know, bowl off spin, open the bat. So we remain fully open for selection at this stage.
From the archives, and in this, the 174th episode of Reverse Threat Radio, Andy Ryan is going to be telling us the story of when the unstoppable Sonny Ramadan was stopped.
It's 1957 and we're at Edgbaston for the first test of the West Indies tour of England. Peter May's won the toss and England are going to have a bat. Now, the West Indies have reason to be hopeful. When they last toured England 7 years before, they'd won the series 3-1, and at the heart of that success had been their star spin duo, Alf Valentine and Sonny Ramadan. Valentine wasn't picked for Edgbaston, but Ramadan soon got to work. So here's Wisden. Ramadan kept his opponents guessing by his peculiar flick of the wrist. None could tell his intention, whether he was attempting off spin or leg spin. He kept his shirt sleeves buttoned at the wrist, and it was difficult to see how the ball left his right hand. He acquired very little spin, and the majority of his wickets were taken with straight balls.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the idea of a spinner having that degree of mystery around them at the beginning of a test series, because now, of course, you've analysed everything, you've analysed all of the video footage, and that's just an immediate difference from what we'd expect. Now, and of course, people have mystery balls now, but in terms of what are they going to bowl running up to the crease, and the fact that you could, you know, kind of button up your cuff up to the wrist and disguise the way your arm was flicking is an interesting situation for the batsman to be in.
Absolutely, and I'm such a fan of the bowler who can just, you know, bit of leg spin, bit of off spin. I think that's, you know, you do still get that occasionally, but I think it is well, understandably, because the skills involved, it is quite a rare.
I do that, but even I'm not sure which way it's going to come out. So no one of the batsmen is right. Anyway, on with the story. 1957, first test at the Oval,
and Ramadan is incredibly successful in this first innings. He takes 7 for 49. They're the finest figures of his test career, and England were routed for 186. The West Indies pile on 474 in response, so they are completely dominant at this stage. In the second innings, Ramadan picks up where he'd left off. He quickly dismisses Peter Richardson and Doug Insull to leave England 65 for 2. So the West Indies are still over 200 ahead. Ramadan seems unstoppable, and he would be forgiven for feeling confident that he was going to wrap things up quickly. An innings victory seemed on the cards, but that's not how events transpired. Peter May and Colin Cowdery had a plan. At this time, a batsman could not be out LBW if they were hit on the pad outside the line of the stumps, even if they were not playing a shot. So May and Cowdery repeatedly got a big stride in with their left foot and simply padded Ramadan away. The Trinidadian repeatedly appealed for LBW, but it was no good. He was completely negated, and the result was record-breaking. May and Cowdery put on 411 in what was then the highest partnership for a fourth wicket in Test cricket. May's unbeaten 285 was the highest score by an England captain until Graham Gooch made a triple ton in the 90s. But the records that are still standing to this day belong to Ramadan. His 588 deliveries over 98 overs remain the most balls bowled in a first-class innings. His 774 over 129 overs remain the most balls bowled in a test match.
129 overs. So you can't be out if you pad up to a ball that pitches outside off or hits you outside off. Hits you outside off.
Let's get this right. So it's got to hit you outside off. Yeah. So now if I pad up outside off and I don't offer a shot, but
you can be out LBW.
The umpire's Exactly. If the umpire's verdict is that it's angling in, et cetera, et cetera, you can give, which, you know, I think we're now very comfortable with. It's the risk in the obvious risk in padding up.
So do you have a sense of why Ramadan just wasn't bowling straighter onto the stumps to mitigate?
Well, that, this is
actually his turn out of the, because then he couldn't, if he was turning it, then it would take the LB out anyway. Mm-hmm.
This is actually the one great frustration I had researching this, is you can get a wonderful account of the game. What you can't quite get is the sort of nitty-gritty about did Ramadan adjust? So yeah. I think you're absolutely right that the obvious strategy you would think here is to bowl much more wicket to wicket, because at that stage you take out the option of padding up. Now, probably the most frustrating thing is, given his exploits, I've found nothing on Ramadan's own reflections on the game.
He probably never wanted to talk about it again.
Well, yes, you'd be the brave interviewer, yes, sort of bringing it up.
Take us back to the 117th over of those 129.
Well, I think, and to give you an idea, I mean, the sort of, in terms of what an experience it was for him, the Guardian's obit of Ramadan described that second innings as soul-destroying. The Times obituary says his fingers were bleeding by the end, which I guess is not surprising. I mean, you know, you get bowlers who bowl a lot less than that. What's interesting, particularly on this question of did he adjust? So England's 12th man, Johnny Wardle, who was a fellow spinner, and I guess, you know, there's that sort of spinners' union, he recalled, "I could have cried for Sonny. I reckon a good proportion of them were absolutely plumb." Now, what's not clear from this quote is, does Wardle mean that they were hitting outside off but going on to hit the stumps, i.e., plumb in the sense of it would have hit the stumps but not in the sense of out? Or did he actually mean the umpires had a bit of a shocker here? Did he actually mean that, you know, Ramadan did straighten and the umpires just weren't going for him? It's hard to, it's you know, there's no footage. The match reports are sort of a little bit too anodyne to get that detail. I wonder, again, the other thing, I was very struck by the scorecard. Why does John Goddard, the West Indian captain, just keep bowling Ramadan? Because that's the other thing. You think, why do you sort of put him through this? The interesting thing is that however much May and Cowdery controlled him, they never really got away from him. So he was very economical. He was sort of going at less than two and over. So I don't know if to some extent the West Indies said, look, you're not taking wickets, but you are still, you know, you are still keeping this tight. So
and there are two sides of this.
Side of things.
There are two sides as well in, you know, the how this played out for Ramadan, but then also with May and Cowdery, it's very rare that in any sport someone has a kind of a sort of eureka moment in terms of the rules that allows them to do something that completely changes the way the game is played. The thing actually that springs to mind is in the Six Nations in rugby union a few years ago, when England were playing, I think, Italy, and Italy realised that if they only committed one man to the breakdown, then the offside rule didn't apply. And it completely, like, England had no idea. England, massively the superior team, had no idea how to respond to this. And it's because someone in the Italy camp had suddenly thought, hang on, here's a rule that no one has ever exploited in the history of the game. How do we exploit this? And it's kind of similar from, you know, May and Cowdery, that what seems like kind of just dour defensive play actually takes quite a lot of tactical chutzpah to see through.
I agree, because it's also very interesting, because it suggests, and your Italy example is really interesting, because it suggests that a lot of the time players are bound by convention, really.
Yes.
They're like, well, we don't do this.
There is an accepted interpretation of the rules that is different from actually what the rules say.
Yeah. The other thing I wonder, to try and give them sort of credit, because I think some of the coverage now of this historically tends to see Cowdery and May as somehow a bit underhand, when of course it was the rules of the game. You know, it takes a bit of execution as well. It's not padding up in itself against a sort of decent spinner who's varying his pace and varying his leg. It still takes some skill as well. So I think it's probably worth recognising that.
So how did the game end?
It, not surprisingly, a 400-run partnership rather transformed the game and transformed the momentum. So West Indies were very much the side under pressure. England declared 583 for four, you know, one of those truly ridiculous looking scorecards. They left West Indies with a nominal chase of 296, but more practically, they had just over 2 hours to bat to secure the draw. Presumably exhausted by their efforts in the field, the Windies slide to 68 for seven, but their captain Goddard made a 40-minute unbeaten naught to get them home. I love a long duck. A long unbeaten duck is always a sort of particular spectator pleasure. Exactly. And Ramadan would take just five more wickets in the remaining four tests, which I think really suggests that England had success in negating him. But also, I would imagine that the sheer workload he went to in Edgbaston presumably was, you know, may well have had long-term consequences, at least for that series. You do read some accounts that seem to suggest he was never the same bowler again. I think that's possibly a stretch. I mean, England were back in the West Indies by 1960, and he took 17 wickets at 28 apiece, which is, you know, plenty respectable. There's also a suggestion in some of the accounts of this game that Ramdin's travails at Edgbaston prompted a change in the LBW law to the law we know now and are comfortable with that prevents you not offering a shot and just defending in that way. The law was eventually changed, but I think it's worth noting that this didn't happen until 1980. So I think you're left either with the view that if Ramadan did have an impact on the rule, the authorities took an awful long time to do anything about it. Or perhaps actually less attention was paid to this at the time than we might now think in hindsight. To the review, and for this episode we've been watching Cricket's Greatest Game. It was released in 2022. It's directed by Ashley Gething, who's got an extensive background in historical documentaries. Now Simon Hughes of Analyst fame is listed as a writer alongside Gething. The documentary tells the story of England's victory over New Zealand in the 2019 World Cup final, a game that I imagine, you know, most of our listeners probably have some recollection of. It's currently available on BBC iPlayer, so it's that's where you can find it at the moment. Toby, did this game did this documentary pleasantly transport you back to that summer day in 2019?
Yes, it did. It certainly transported me back, and any opportunity to revisit that game I think is a welcome one, because what an extraordinary game it was. The structure of the documentary is quite interesting, because it basically, the kind of backbone, the narrative backbone is the game, but then we dive off at different points to meet some of the players or to look back at England's fortunes through the tournament. I think as a, you know, as an England fan and a cricket lover, I'll take any opportunity to relive that game wherever I can. The divings off into different areas I've found mostly uninformative and almost unanimously a bit tedious. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, this is slightly the challenge, isn't it? And I think I agree with you. It's a perfectly decent film. It tells a story. I think what frustrated me about it, or one of the many things that frustrated me about it, was it felt it fitted a template that I think we've come to know now with a sort of modern prestige sports documentary. The stage shots of players in dramatic settings are a particular bugbear for me. So we have Jofra Archer sitting on a beach, Moeen Ali on the roof of a skyscraper. That one I found particularly inexplicable.
But it's offsetting Johnny Bairstow on the top of a mountain somewhere. I think that's the thing. It's like a city boy and the country boy. Can't you tell? This is, you know, getting us deep insights into their characters. Get some poetry in you.
I'd love to sort of come along on one of these hilarious shoots where you pose someone in this ridiculous setting. I don't think anyone can beat Trevor Bayliss on a motorized lawnmower though, for sort of general absurdity. And you know, we get into the problem, and I think better documentaries solve this, that for anyone who watches any sport for a long period of time, most players are much better at doing sport than talking about it. We've got the exceptions. We can all think of the exceptions who are brilliant and talk, you know, lucidly about the sport. and good interviewers find a way through it. I won't, well, okay, stop me when I get too far into rant mode, but here are a couple of the gems that we're treated to. So Chris Woke says of the final that it could define your career. So I think that's if that was a revelation, if ever needed one. Ben Stokes on batting in the Super over after having already batted for 30 overs. I was quite tired, but it's never over until it's over. And one player who I now forget saying of winning the World Cup that it was an overwhelming feeling, really.
I think
one of the players here, but...
You know. Yeah, I mean, they are media trained to talk in a certain way. And so, of course, when you put them in front of the documentary about the defining moment in their life, of course, they're going to talk about the fact that it wasn't over until it was over and that it was overwhelming and that it was career defining. I think the failure is probably that they are never... This film seeks to allow them to build their own myth rather than to really interrogate. Like, there is something wonderful about this moment and something deep and meaningful about this group of individuals from all different backgrounds in life coming together. Like, the framework, there's something that the film is trying to get at, which I actually think is quite true, but it's never interrogated. They allow the participants themselves to build that. There's no one there going, well, actually, was that really true, and how did this, and no one thinks that actually this myth would be stronger, this moment would be more exalted if we were actually able to grapple with it a bit more than single line platitudes. And so we do just have sound bites, basically. It's single sentence sound bites that make up the overall structure of this.
It's exactly that format. It's a format based on the idea that the audience can't pay attention for, you know, more than a few seconds. So we get quick quote and then next player, next player, next player. Your point around the background of the players is interesting. I think the way you framed it there in terms of showing how this team comes together from all these disparate regions in the UK has
and
made...
And around the world.
I guess has made... And around the world, exactly. Particularly with this, yeah, with this England team. And it has made me maybe more sympathetic. I mean, I think the problem I have is whenever we do a biography, autobiography on this podcast, and we have a section about childhood, it is almost always interminably boring, because yep. What professional sportsmen generally do in their childhood is they get quite good at sport and they work very hard at it.
They play obsessively in the sport.
They play it a lot. And the problem, and maybe this is not the film's fault, maybe this is just sport's fault, when you go back to everyone's home club, the narrative you get is basically the same, but just in a different setting. You know, when we go to Ireland with Owen Morgan, when we go to the Northeast with Mark Wood, or am I being unfair?
I think you're being a little bit unfair. I think partly you're being fair and partly you're being unfair. How's that for a response that sits on the fence? But I think that they absolutely could have leaned more into the... So I suppose part of the narrative, what they seem to be getting at, is this narrative around here are all these people with really powerful backstories that culminated in this one particular cricket game, and therefore we care more about this game of cricket because we know something about the people who played in it. But again, I just don't think that they really push those narratives hard enough. You know, it's interesting with Johnny Bairstow, for instance, that... And I realize it probably sounds grossly insensitive to say this, but when talking about his backstory, they don't actually talk about the death of his father at all. They talk about his mother having cancer twice, which I'm sure is a very formative thing, but they don't talk about that, presumably at his request, because they don't want to talk about that. But again, it's just like a symbol of how all of these people are presenting themselves as they want to be presented, rather than actually, let's really look at what this moment meant to these people. Let's really push them to realize something new. Just by the way, as a brief aside, you mentioned Trevor Bayliss earlier. Did you notice Ben Stokes' comment earlier in the documentary, when, which they leave in, and he sort of says as an off-camera aside, when they mentioned something about Trevor Bayliss, and Ben Stokes said, oh, you've got Trevor to talk on this. How much did you have to pay him to do this, to do that? Did you notice that? And I kind of wondered
now
to myself...
Mention it.
I wonder to myself, what exactly does he mean by that? Does he mean he's so burnt somehow by the England setup that he doesn't want to come back? Or does he just mean Trevor hates doing media interviews, infamously a bit grumpy? But I thought that was very,
or
very
just,
curious.
Or just generally
side.
Loves money. No, now you mention it, I do remember it. And you're right, it sort of sticks out as a rare, because there aren't many... Yes, genuinely candid moments like that, yes, are pretty rare. If I gave you the choice and you had a luxurious Sunday night, you know, and you thought, you know what, I'd love to settle down and reminisce over 2019 World Cup final. You've just poured yourself a lovely pale ale. And you've got 90 minutes. Would you watch this film or would you settle down with a highlight package of the game?
I've watched the highlights anytime. But I don't think I'm the audience. I think this is an audience that is... I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to build the public profile of the 2005 Ashes around the 2019 final in retrospect. And so I don't think I'm the audience. I think it's that audience of more general public who... they think will fall in love with the team for the first time. What would you do? I mean, I think I can guess the answer.
Well, it's a slightly leading question, isn't it? I would settle down with the highlight package, which I think, by the way, I'm actually saying partly as, I guess, a criticism of the film, but also just an acknowledgement of what a hard job this film has. Because I think when you're trying to compete with the drama of the game itself, I think it's sort of impossible. I think you make a really important point though about audience though, and I mean, I think it's something we always try to bear in mind on this podcast, and maybe I haven't done a good enough job of doing it during this review. I think there is a considerable audience that will have a lot of fun with this film. You know, I think it's fun to see the players, it's fun to revisit the game. I just wonder if we make more and more documentaries like this, the sort of play it safe, don't really interview, don't really prod too hard, we are, I think, on balance, we're the poorer for it. You know, I'm sure this will do very well streaming. I'm sure it has done very well, but it's the safe option. It's the sort of cop-out.
Yeah, I agree. It's the kind of Amazon Prime model that we saw in that the test, that documentary about the Australian test team as well. And the kind of over sentimentalizing actually robs the... It's difficult to then go and appreciate the drama of a great test match having watched a documentary like this, actually, and having your expectations set like this. Now, having said all of these things, I'm sure there were some bits you loved about the... If you had to tell me about the bits that you loved about this documentary, what would you be telling me about?
I just your point on the test, just to quickly say that I completely agree, because I think when we watched the test, the two of us were saying, oh, this is a bit overproduced, it's a bit, oh, you can see Cricket Australia's got its fingers all over it. In defense of the test, I think it's a lot more gritty than this, isn't it?
Yeah,
exactly. What did I enjoy? I really enjoyed Owen Morgan. This England team, obviously the whole brand is about, you know, we always believe we're always going to win. He says in an interview that at the point when New Zealand needed just 7 or 4 in the super over, he says, I just didn't see us getting over the line. And I really like that, because I think sometimes it's much more human to say, I thought we were going to lose, rather than this, you know, relentless positivity.
I knew that it was never over until it was over.
Exactly, which I think maybe I find a bit wearing. I liked the humour of Mark Wood, who was going out for the final ball as a non-striker, and he was going out with every bit of padding on, which was, given that his entire role at that point was simply to sprint quickly, was quite entertaining. What about you? What stuck with you?
I have to say there were a few things that I learned that sort of fleshed out some of the characters of some of the cricketers through the little anecdotal packages about them. I also enjoyed hearing a bit more about Trevor Bayliss, actually, and particularly the moment after the semi-final where, you know, England... Australia had never lost a semi-final. England beat them, thrashed them, absolutely thrashed Australia. And they're celebrating in the dressing rooms, and Trevor Bayliss just comes in and goes, why are you celebrating? There's absolutely no reason to be celebrating at this point, which makes kind of total sense. But it's an interesting indication of what it is that someone like that brings in terms of defining the culture of a team and the culture of a dressing room. I think, you know, the great thing about the BBC is it's free at the point of use. And on that basis alone, if you have nothing else to do for 90 minutes and have pay your license fee, then you might as well spend a little bit of time watching this. Don't let Andy put you off. but I wouldn't, I don't think either of us would necessarily suggest this being either sought out from a viewer's perspective or sought out as a template for how games and series should be revisited. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's fair. I think hearing you talk about Trevor Bayliss just then made me realise that actually you'd probably have had more fun with a narrower focus, wouldn't you? If you'd just said, like, let's do the Trevor Bayliss story. You know, that might have been really fun, coming over to England, turning the side
Trevor
around.
Trevor Bayliss isn't very sexy, though, in any sense.
He's not. Well, this is the problem. You would have made a documentary that me and you would have watched, but ultimately that's not a that's probably not the basis for a successful
You need more people who find Trevor
operation.
Bayliss sexy. That's the issue. Anyway, look, on that note, before we go any further down that rabbit hole, that was the 174th episode of Reverse Retro Radio. Next episode, we are going to be dedicating entirely to a retrospective on Trevor Bayliss's career.